Today on Against the Grain, the U.S. and Israel have not only threatened Iran's civilian infrastructure, but have systematically targeted it since the start of their attack.
I would say that the security apparatus in Iran, its hold over public space, has been strengthened by this war.
Historian Golnar Nikpour discusses the Iranian state and prison system since the early 20th century, and places recent mass protests, the largest in Iranian history, in the context of regular cycles of protest and repression in modern Iranian history. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Islamic Republic of Iran has one of the biggest prison populations in the world, and its apparatus of repression is formidable, as witnessed by the recent clampdown and massacre of protesters. My guest argues, however, that we should attribute Iran's enormous prison population not just to the Islamic Republic, repressive as it is, but to see it also in the context of both repression and resistance through modern Iranian history, including during the U.S.-backed Pahlavi dynasty. And as Golnar Nikpour argues, we can't understand incarceration and repression in Iran without seeing it in the context of global mass incarceration pioneered by the United States. Golnar Nikpour is Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth and the author of The Incarcerated Modern, Prisons and Public Life in Iran. Golnar, I'd like to start by asking you about the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Do we have enough information to know how significant the damage has been to the infrastructure of civilian life and to the Iranian people?
The damage has been extensive. I mean, the Islamic Republic essentially took the approach. It saw this round of warfare as an existential threat, and its approach has been to absorb quite a few really serious body blows in its effort to sort of inflict as much return damage as needed to ward off a potential future attack, right? But for the people in Iran, this has meant an enormous and devastating set of consequences. Dozens of universities have been hit, dozens of schools, important steel manufacturing centers that are the absolute heart of Iranian industry, a number of bridges, some tens of thousands of civilian homes, apartment buildings. And we don't know the full extent of the damage in every single city. Oil infrastructure has been hit quite hard. I mean, there was even bombings of pistachio farms, all sorts of industrial, educational, and other forms of infrastructure have been hit quite hard. And I think that damage is going to take quite a bit of time to repair if and when it's repaired. So I have been calling this a war on infrastructure, right? It's been a concerted effort. Once it especially became clear that the political goals of the U.S.-Israeli effort were not going according to the most, you know, the rosy projections that the Israelis in particular had, where there would be quick regime change, where missile capability would be degraded so quickly that there would be very little economic fallout. Once it was clear that those big picture goals weren't going to be met, it became quite evident that the Israeli goal in particular was to degrade Iranian economic capacity for as long of a time as is possible, right? To create a situation where the Islamic Republic is in an absolute economic crisis. And that's why you see not only attacks on higher education, most famously airstrike on March 28th that hit Tehran's famed University of Science and Technology, but also attacks on industry. An untold number of tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of jobs were lost over the course of this war. Because if you think about it, if you bomb a factory, it's not just bombing the wealth that would come from selling those goods later. It's also bombing, it's destroying those people's jobs. So my sense is that economic effort was a kind of plan B on the part of the Israelis to create the economic conditions that would make it very, very difficult for Iran to crawl out of the hole that it has been put into. And on the other side, we see that Iran has explicitly named reparations for these attacks as one of their points of their own peace demands, right? That there has to be remuneration for this enormous assault on its infrastructure.
Given what you've said about this being a war on infrastructure, how do you understand Trump's threat last week, not just to destroy Iran's bridges and power plants, which many people have denounced as war crimes, but also stating that a whole civilization will die? How would you understand those threats in the context of what actually has already taken place?
We have two different ways to look at what has happened. On the one hand, from the macro picture, it might look like the U.S. and Israel backed off from some of the most apocalyptic threats that Trump made in terms of, as you said, wiping out an entire civilization. But although at no point was there a kind of a total assault on infrastructure that we were, you know, those of us kind of watching were really fearing, there was an enormous outlay of military effort to destroy civilian infrastructure. And that has been the modus operandi of the Israelis over the course of the last several years in Gaza and now in Lebanon. It's a doctrine called the Dahiya Doctrine, which is an Israeli military strategy that is specifically oriented around destroying civilian infrastructure. That it's about sort of showing overwhelming force such that the people seeing that overwhelming force simply submit to the power in question, in this case Israel, or in the case of the Iran war, the United States. I don't want to overemphasize the Israeli provenance of this strategy, because of course we know that the United States has done similar things in Iraq, in Vietnam before it, right? So this is not new to the strategies of American empire. But what was new is the kind of announcement of war crimes in advance on social media in such a cavalier fashion, and the seeming lack of strategy, right? A strategy of incoherence, like a maybe purposeful strategy of seeming like one day Trump is talking about peace or an agreement and the next day about destruction. So very plainly, we have a few different things in the picture. On the one hand, this explicit doctrine of destroying civilian infrastructure that both the Israelis and the Americans have used to quite catastrophic effect in the past, and seemingly holding off on some of the worst possibilities, including a nuclear option or the wiping out of all, you know, attempt at wiping out even more civilian infrastructure. But in the meanwhile, we shouldn't lose sight of what has been destroyed. And again, we're talking about several bridges, several apartment complexes were hit. The very, very first hours of the war, girls' elementary school was hit, leading to the deaths of some 175 people, most of whom were school children, right? So we all knew about the Minob school bombing, and the attacks on infrastructure were daily, right? So in some of the last hours before the now very, very fragile ceasefire was agreed to, we saw attacks that hit one of the oldest synagogues in Tehran, bridges, more schools, cafes. So all different levels of civilian infrastructure were hit, including cultural heritage sites in Iran, which some of which are quite old and precious, really human heritage as much as Iranian, railways, logistics centers. Some of these things you could reasonably say have, as the Americans and Israelis have liked to say, have dual use, but most of it doesn't. I mean, most of it is simply civilian infrastructure. And really strains the idea of dual use. So you know, the idea from the point of view of the Americans and Israelis is you can hit, for instance, engineering colleges because engineers might at some point be part of the military industrial complex in Iran. But by that logic, you could bomb any university in the world. And I think we would hopefully be opposed to that as a strategy of war, right? So what the Israelis and Americans were selling is this idea that these infrastructures are dual use, but in reality, we're talking about roads and bridges and highways and schools and apartments and everything that ordinary people use every single day. There's already been enormous inflationary effects on currency in Iran. And we have to remember that when the big protests that sort of were the prelude to this moment happened in December and January, they were economic protests at first. They become political and more people joined them, but they were about inflation and sort of everyday affordability issues that were badly exacerbated by US-led sanctions that has immiserated Iranian people for generations. So we're already in a situation in which the Iranian economy was quite fragile, and this is only going to exacerbate the effects on ordinary people's lives.
And we'll return to those mass protests. But I wanted to ask you about the consequences for dissent within Iran with the US-Israeli attack. Of course, Iranians around the world are a broadly varied group with quite different politics, but some in the Iranian diaspora were hoping that the attack on Iran might lead to a better situation internally in Iran, while others warned that an attack would, in fact, harden the regime and harden repression, harden the Islamic Republic against its internal opponents. What have we seen? What has been apparent at this point?
At this point, we can say already that the Islamic Republic has, if anything, doubled down on its repressive tactics to deal with internal dissent. At the same time that the war has been happening over the course of the last several weeks, the Islamic Republic has moved forward with executions of protesters who it's now saying, on top of other charges that have been leveled against protesters in the past, there's now the language of treason being used. And there's the claim that these are people who have essentially collaborated with Iran's enemies, the United States and Israel, to foment treasonous outcomes. So even during the course of the war, we've seen that the security apparatus, the internal repressive apparatus of the Islamic Republic, has not only not slowed its efforts towards internal repression, but if anything, has accelerated the use of some of its most extreme tactics, including executions. We have to wait and see exactly what will happen next, but I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that the situation as it's unfolded is going to lead to the further securitization of the internal context in Iran. We have a situation where the highest levels of both military command and the sort of civilian command, up to including a former now assassinated leader Khamenei the Elder, have been replaced with a younger and more militant in many ways generation. Militant particularly in the sense that there is a sense that there needs to be kind of swift and absolute responses to existential threats, right? One of the things that I tell my students and Americans all the time that they don't necessarily know is that many of the figures that have been assassinated in the last several weeks, from Khamenei to Larijani and others, took, in some cases, relatively pragmatic postures. For instance, Khamenei himself was a proponent of a sort of strategic deterrence. You know, after Qasem Soleimani was killed, after nuclear scientists were assassinated over the last few years, the Iranian response has been quite subdued. And a lot of that had to do with the upper levels of the Islamic Republic's leadership thinking that that was a better strategy than all-out war. You have now a younger generation who has been pushing for a more confrontational posture, saying that this is the only thing that the United States is going to understand, is if it is actually hurt by Islamic Republic's actions, that it won't understand strategic deterrence, it will only understand like something like the Strait of Hormuz being closed. We can see a kind of similar attitude with regard to internal dissent. Obviously, Iran has been repressive to dissent over the course of many decades. I wouldn't want to sugarcoat that whatsoever. And yet, there is, if anything, I see a sort of rapidly shrinking public context in which sort of internal dissent can be brought to bear on the Islamic Republic. So I see the government sort of essentially calling a permanent state of emergency. Now their paranoia about the United States and Israel being on the verge of attacking them at any time has been proven correct. So that paranoia and that sort of sense of siege, I can only imagine is going to exacerbate what is a state of emergency, a sort of permanent state of emergency for ordinary Iranians who have been trying to carve out spaces of dissent over the last many decades, have been trying to sort of push reformist measures from within for many decades, but are now seeing some of those avenues all the more closed off. I mean, in many cases, they had been closed off. A sense of despair had already overtaken a lot of the Iranian opposition inside of the country. But I see that in the short term worsening, although people are already writing about and thinking about, you know, I've seen writing and thinking from inside of Iran about what can we do now to sort of bring Iranians back together and face this new set of challenges that has emerged. And you're absolutely right that this is, we're talking about a very, very diverse country. 91 or 2 million people in the country, 5 or 6 million people Iranian descent in the diaspora. And it's an extremely diverse political world, right? I would really caution against believing anyone who's trying to sell you an absolute sense of what Iranians want. You see that in the American media all the time. Iranians want this, Iranians want that. Trump himself said Iranians want the bombs. And I would just really caution against an understanding the sort of lay of the land as being conducive to any kind of singularity, any kind of statement that says Iranians want X, Y, or Z, whatever that might be. Because we have a really, really diverse, internally diverse population, many different ethnicities, religions, languages spoken, class-based backgrounds, professional backgrounds, political worldviews. And I think some things remain to be seen about how people address these new set of crises that have been put before them. But certainly I would say that the security apparatus in Iran, its hold over public space has been strengthened by this war.
This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with historian of Iran, Golnar Nikpur. So, Golnar, you were just saying that there is not some unified Iranian perspective, that it's an incredibly varied country. I wonder if you could talk about the protest movements that you mentioned that surged at the end of December and into the early months of this year, which have been considered the largest movements in Iran since the 1979 revolution that ultimately led to the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Can you characterize that movement? How would you describe its makeup?
One thing I would want to say is that we have to understand the protests, the late 2025, early 2026 protests, December and January in our calendar, so just a few months ago, they were quite enormous, quite intense. They became quite deadly as the Islamic Republic opened fire on protesters, killing several thousand. We don't have certain numbers about that, but it seems that the numbers are in the multiple thousands. That protest movement, we have to understand it as the most recent mass protests in the country, in a country that has seen mass protests in cyclical ways, not just since the beginning of the Islamic Republic, but really since the 1890s. There have been mass protests demanding a future every few years since the 1890s that are quite diverse in their makeup. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think sometimes we take the shorter view, but when it comes to protest movements in Iran, I think it's important to take a very, very long view and understand that we can't really grasp them in their totality without putting them into that broader context. But having said that, in the short term, what I would say is that the most recent wave of protests began as economic protests. And they began as protests against rapid inflation, the devaluation of Iranian currency, economic corruption. There's an enormous frustration with the fact that well-positioned members of the Islamic Republic elite and its sort of security apparatus have been able to enrich themselves in the context of a sanctions economy that has immiserated the mass of Iranians. Something between 30 and 40% of Iranians live under the poverty line. This was a crisis before the war, right? And it was an economic crisis that was really hitting multiple strata of Iranian society. And one of the things that was quite important about that wave of protests is that it drew into the protest several constituencies that are typically considered pro-Islamic Republic or part of the Islamic Republic base, including members of the bazaar and merchant classes. And that's why in the very, very first days of the protests, there was a slightly conciliatory tone that the Islamic Republic took. I mean, this would change quite dramatically very quickly, but if we go back to that very beginning of the protests in December, there was a tone of, we understand your pain. We know that there's been these, that these are legitimate grievances and we have to address them in X, Y, and Z fashion. Once the protests became more widespread and they started to include political demands as opposed to just sort of beyond sort of being bread protests, so to speak, once they started including students and younger people, more oppositional factions, and started making demands that were more anti-government, the tenor of the response from the Islamic Republic changed quite dramatically. And instead of being seen as, at least to some extent, legitimate protests, they started being called riots. They started being called sort of agent provocateurs. There was the implication from official sources that these were protests being fomented by the Israelis or by the Americans or and so on and so forth. We do now have a sense that there were, American hands involved. The New York Times was reported. And Trump himself said that there were arms sent into the country in January. I do want to disaggregate, though, between the fact that the protests, at least initially, are an organic outpouring across a mass of different players in Iran, from working classes, middle classes, student movement, labor movement, all these different sort of organic civil society forces that are demanding economic transformation as well as political transformation, that predates what becomes the most dire part of what happened in early January, when several thousand people were massacred. The Islamic Republic says that there were sort of agent provocateurs on the street. There's a lot we still need to unpack about what happened. But what we do know is that the Islamic Republic opened fire in dozens of cities across the country and killed several thousand people. The most recent protest before that, the Women Life Freedom protests, they were also quite intensely, but they in fact won some de facto victories. They happened in 2022 with the police killing of a young Kurdish Iranian woman, Mahsa Jina Amini. And those protests seemed to win a slight thaw in the public forum, where women across the country, especially in the big cities, for the last few years have defied the mandatory hijab laws but haven't been penalized for it. It didn't win a legal change, but it won a kind of de facto social loosening that seemed to be one of the kind of hopeful signs that some of us took from that movement. This protest movement, it had a much less hopeful ending. I mean, of course, 2022 was repressed quite intensely, but the massacre in January of this year, I would say, elicited a sort of mass sense of despair, because there's very much the feeling over the last several years that the reformist efforts of the late 1990s, the 2000s, all of these internal efforts from civil society in Iran to force the Islamic Republic to change from within, to sort of take the democratic levers that do exist in the country and try to use them to effectuate a democratic thaw, seem to have exhausted themselves and end up in this moment of massacre that is then seemingly sort of manipulated or even egged on by external forces that then declare war on Iran. So we've really reached a kind of crossroads where all of the different tendencies and trends of the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years seem to have come to a head in this moment.
You emphasize the importance of situating oppositional movements in Iran in historical terms. And I wonder if you could remind our listeners of the different regimes that have ruled Iran from the early 20th century until now, until the 21st.
Iran actually undergoes an enormous set of transformations in the 20th century. At the dawn of the 20th century, it is under a monarchy by the name of the Qajar monarchy. And that government is quite decentralized, quite weak. It's a decentralized, kind of even fading imperial formation that is dragged into making what are essentially modern reforms to its state structure by reformers within and by the pressures placed on it by Iranian intellectuals, reformists, and so forth. So we talk about all of this infrastructure that's been attacked in the last several weeks. We have to understand that infrastructure is a relatively, all of it has been built over the course of the last a little bit over a century. The Qajar dynasty is sort of protested from within in 1905 to 1911 with this large constitutional revolution that happens in those years. This leads us to a moment when, in the 1920s, a new monarchy, a new dynasty is brought to power. It comes to be called the Pahlavi dynasty, and those are the two shahs that predate the Islamic Republic. So from 1925 to 1979, you have the Pahlavi monarchy, and Reza Khan, who becomes Reza Shah, the first Pahlavi dynast, comes to power at first through a military coup. He's a really interesting figure because he's from not from an aristocratic background. He's not from a elite background. He's kind of a social nobody who joins the Cossack Brigade, the Iranian Cossack Brigade, and rises through its ranks and undertakes a military coup to come to power. He's basically a rags-to-riches story, but in the context of this sort of modernizing military apparatus. That coup, the 1921 coup, is supported by the British, who start to see the Qajars as an actual impediment to their colonial desires, simply because they're so corrupt and so incapable that the British think that this sort of military coup will be to their benefit. Reza Shah eventually is coronated king in 1925, and the Pahlavi government undertakes this enormous centralization effort that really transforms the country into the sort of nation state that we see today. It builds out an enormous amount of infrastructure. It expands the military. It expands education. It expands all of the institutions of modern statehood and entrenches them in a way that has only subsequently grown. Reza Shah and then his son, Mohammad Reza Shah, they're autocratic. The constitutionalists, who had earlier demanded justice, a constitution, parliamentary norms, sort of the institutions of liberal democracy, start to demand in the 1920s a figure like Reza Shah. They see him as a potential unifier. They're talking about the need for these are quotes that are coming directly from those sources, a Mussolini-like figure who can keep Iran from being cut up, carved up by the colonial powers. So that's an important thing for a precursor to this current moment too. Iranians really fear in the 1920s, there's all of these forces that seem to be on the verge of carving the country into little ethnic statelets or, you know, spheres of influence, different colonial powers trying to carve up different concessions for themselves. So Reza Shah is seen as someone who, while authoritarian, while quite brutal, is able to unify the country under a centralized rule. This includes violent forced sedentarization of the tribes, the building out of the prison system, all sorts of things that I write about in my work. His son comes to power in 1941. Just as Reza Shah is helped to the throne by the British, he is forced off the throne by the Allied occupation of Iran. So most, you know, we see that in the modern era, other than until we get to the Islamic Republic period, leadership in Iran changes at the behest, at the demands of colonial powers, right? So in 1941, Reza Shah is forced to abdicate. His young son is brought to the throne. Between 1941 and 1953, we get a period of relative political opening in the country, relative democratic opening, because the young Shah is not yet able to sort of demand he doesn't have the gravitas and the support in the military and the sort of support institutionally to be a strong man in the tradition of his father. And once there's that little bit of opening, you see all these political parties emerge, all these newspapers emerge. It's not a totally free society between 1941 and 1953. There's still repression, but it's relatively free. And so you see this utter flowering. It's a dream for the historian, because we have a lot of sources from that period, because there's so many newspapers and memoirs and everything is being published, and it's just a different type of time. That openness ends with the 1953 CIA-led coup in the country against a popular anti-colonial nationalist by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh, who is deposed because in his 2 years in power as prime minister, he nationalizes Iranian oil and attempts to bring Iranian oil under full Iranian control, attempting to wrestle it away from British a British concession and British colonial control, right? This is considered essentially a non-starter for the European powers and for the United States. For the first time, really gets deeply enmeshed and involved in Iranian politics in this time period. Mossadegh is removed. The young Mohammad Reza Shah, who's a little bit less young at this point, is re-empowered. He's never taken off the throne under the Mossadegh period, but Mossadegh is attempting to sort of transform the monarchy into something like what it looks like in constitutional monarchies, where the monarch is more of a figurehead. And he's trying to internally transform the system to be more democratic within, and he and his party have nationalized oil as part of that process. The CIA-led coup in the country re-empowers Mohammad Reza Shah and inaugurates what becomes an increasingly authoritarian turn in the Shah's governance. It's at this point that a new secret police and intelligence system named SAVAK is founded and becomes quite repressive towards internal dissent. So that moment of kind of democratic flowering, where we see these two very important mid-century political parties, the Nationalist National Front, which is Mossadegh's party on the one hand, and the Communist Tudeh party, which is the only mass-based party in modern Iranian history, meaning that ordinary people can join and it becomes quite large and has these very, very successful strikes in the oil industry that are part of the mechanism through which oil nationalization is able to flower. All of that is repressed quite brutally and severely authoritarian turn in the country, such that by the mid-1970s, the Shah declares it a one-party state and it sort of crowns himself. He's really feeling himself at that point. He feels that he's totally obliterated internal dissent in the form of the Tudeh and the National Front. And although there is a rising guerrilla movement in the 1970s, the Shah's intelligence apparatus is quite repressive towards that as well. And the Shah by the mid-70s feels that he's on firm footing. He's getting an enormous amount of funding and aid from the United States. He's built up the military into being the biggest in the region. There is a kind of triumphalist sense that he's defeated all of his enemies. It's only a few years after that moment, though, that in 1979, there's again a mass internally enormous, quite diverse mass movement that leads eventually to the overthrow of Mohammad Reza Shah and the eventual establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. That first year after the February 1979 Islamic Revolution is, other than between the 1941-50 period, the other moment of great democratic opening in the country before the kind of new government secures its own ability to repress internal dissent. There is this great moment of opening, what's called the, what some Iranian sources will call the springtime of revolution in the country, where there's again newspapers and debates and public, sort of public dissent. But that is sort of slowly but surely crushed. Islamic Republic consolidates power. That's a very contested process that I won't go too much into, that involves years of sort of militant clashes with its opposition. And over the course of the last 47 years, we've been in the period of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The first leader of the country was the Ayatollah Khomeini, the figure at the heart of the 1979 revolution, the leader of the revolution. The second leader was a figure, Ali Khamenei, who was just assassinated a few weeks ago. And now his son, quite improbably, has become the third the sort of leader of the country. Often that'll be called supreme leader in American media and discourses, but that's not a term that's from the Persian. That's just sort of grafting a concept onto the Iranian state. The official title is the leader of the revolution. And now we are in this kind of new moment where it seems that the expanded military intelligence paramilitary apparatus of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is now working hand in glove with this new Khamenei. We don't really have as much of a sense of what the Khamenei, the younger, will be like as a leader, but that brings us up to date, I would say.
I'm speaking with historian Gulnar Nikpour. She is the author of The Incarcerated Modern, Prisons and Public Life in Iran. This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. So the prison population of Iran is very large. And of course, you've been describing a century, more than a century, of repression. There's now over 250,000 people imprisoned in Iran. Yet at the turn of the 20th century, Iran had very few prisoners. How has imprisonment, you know, this tool of repression used by regimes to stamp out movements, actually shaped Iranian political movements?
I'll answer that question by telling you how I came to that realization that there essentially just a little bit more than a century where we go from very, very few prisoners, maybe some dozens of people, even in the late 1920s, just a few hundred people in jailing facilities, to today where Iran is a top 10 per capita carceral state. Although I always note that its numbers of incarcerated people is utterly dwarfed by the number one state in that regard, the United States. I mean, it's like not even in the same stratosphere, but it is a top 10 carceral state depending by different metrics. And so how does that transformation, that institutional, political, social transformation happen? And how do Iranians understand those transformations, right? That's what I'm interested in. So, you know, we have this moment in the turn of the 20th century where Iranian reformists, constitutionalists, revolutionaries, opposition, socialists, all kinds of people are demanding the curtailment of monarchic power and the rule of law. They're convinced that the rule of law, that a kind of routinized, standardized legal state will allow for the kind of reforms that they hope will bring Iran back into a better place, right? So along with those calls for the rule of law comes the expansion of what we think of as repressive arms of the state, right? So if you're demanding the rule of law, even the constitutionalists are saying we need to sort of reform the police. And by reforming the police, that means creating a new modern police force, building new modern prisons, just as in other contexts. Promoted in the Iranian context in the early 20th century, they are seen as, they are the reform, right? They are the humanist reform that is supposed to move Iran away from this era of dungeons and torture. And, you know, and that is really what prison reformists all over the world at that point have been selling for many decades. The idea that prisons and modern policing and modern prisons, modern rule of law, will create a situation where those earlier excesses, torture, public punishments, and so forth, will disappear and will no longer be common practice. So that's one of the things that I'm really keen on explaining in the book, that the Pahlavi government and then later the Islamic Republic government, they don't say, hey, we're out here torturing the opposition. They say, we are building these institutions that are progressive, humane. Eventually the Islamic Republic says that they are institutions that will help create a safer, more healthy body politic that will be free from violence and harm, and that these institutions will reform the people within towards better ends, right? So that's what the prison is promising. And that's what prison reformers are promising in the earlier part of the 20th century, into the mid-century, and really into the current moment, right? You have the same kind of humanist criminological discourse where there's this idea that you're getting antisocial elements off the street and you're transforming them into bettered people, right? Now, on the part of the opposition, though, there's from the beginning critiques of this. And some of the critiques are opposed to the Pahlavi government, for instance, or opposed to the Islamic Republic in a revolutionary or in a very critical mold. But even those who are not necessarily calling for the overthrow of the government are nonetheless demanding certain transformations within the prison system and using the violence inherent to prisons to critique the government. So you have this very interesting thing where, because the Pahlavi government under Reza Shah, and then under Mohammad Reza Shah at first, and then the Islamic Republic under Khomeini and Khamenei, have all used the repressive arms of the state to suppress opposition movements. So you have this interesting thing where opposition movements, important opposition parties, important opposition intellectuals, important opposition figures, in almost all cases pass through prison, in many cases write about it, in some cases create political parties in prisons or engage in political organizing from within prison, and imagine new forms of freedom, of liberation from within the context of confinement, right? So you have this very, very interesting reality where the very mechanism through which the government is attempting to suppress, and does in fact suppress, internal dissent, then turns into an avenue through which those same activists, dissidents, reformists, revolutionaries, whatever the case may be, from all different political backgrounds and with all sorts of different political worldviews, start that they imagine challenging the government precisely from within and because of those prisons. So as a result, you have this context in which prison writing and prison politics is enormously important from really the early 20th century until the current day, is enormously important to Iranian political movements. Great deal of respect given to political dissidents who are incarcerated, and there's a great deal of political organizing that has come from within contexts of incarceration.
Prisoners, of course, differed in different periods of modern Iranian history, from, you know, the left in the 1920s to militant Islamists in the 50s, to the revolutionary guerrillas that you mentioned in the 1970s, and then, of course, more recent opponents of the current regime in the 21st century. Do you see differences in how these different generations of opponents experience prison and had their politics shaped by the experience?
Of course, the institution itself changes a great deal. So the experience of being incarcerated changes a great deal. But there's, you know, some of the earliest prison writing that we have from the 1910s, 1920s is members of the early Iranian Communist Party. And they're writing about efforts, you know, their first efforts, for instance, at having hunger strikes in prison to win concessions from prison authorities for better food or for being able to bring books in or for whatever the case may be. So you, from the very beginning, you see that prisoners, politicized prisoners, are demanding and organizing within prison for better prison conditions as well as for external transformations, right? So you have from, you know, some of the first prison hunger strikes taking place in that relatively early period. The number of prisoners in Iran grows. If in the late 1920s, you have some 400 or so people jailed in Tehran, and now you have something like a quarter of a million people across Iran's jails and prisons, although that number is surely higher now. That was as of a few years ago. The system itself is becoming more and more centralized and less porous with every passing decade and more militarized with every passing decade. It's true not only in Iran, but in contexts around the world. But I should note here that political movements have always been part of the prison population, like what we think of as political prisoners. But the overwhelming majority of people who've been incarcerated in these modern prisons in Iran from the Pahlavi period, the 1920s, the establishment of the founding of the sort of modern prison system in the late 1920s until the contemporary moment, the overwhelming majority of people who've been jailed or incarcerated are common law prisoners. And the overwhelming majority of those are on drug-related charges, right? So one of the big transformations that happens in the country is the very idea that drug-related charges lead to incarceration. That's a totally unheard of idea in the, you know, going into the 20th century. That's just not a thing. And so this is a big social transformation wherein people have to sort of understand and grasp that certain offenses will lead to jail time. But there's political movements that are founded in prisons from the jump. The most famous one is the party that I mentioned earlier, the Tudeh Party, which is the only mass political party in modern Iranian history, one of the biggest communist parties in the Middle East at any point, a serious mid-20th century political force, one with genuine social and political power, led to some of the most sort of consequential worker strikes in Iranian history. That political party is formed in prison in the 1930s by a small group of intellectuals who then sort of are imprisoned at the same time. They're already leftists, they're already sort of aware of each other and working in reading groups and so forth, but it's the context of prison that through which they form this enormously consequential political party. So that's probably the most famous example I could give, but The prison writing through the decades shows that prisoners of one generation have read the prison writing of the generation prior, that there is a sense of knowledge of the system that political dissidents have given. And in today's Islamic Republic, prison writing remains enormously important. Since 1979, there has been an enormous wealth of prison writing, particularly by women, by female dissidents, by members of opposition parties and intellectuals and journalists who've been incarcerated. And that writing has been some of the most consequential political writing of the last several decades as well. So you just have this long-standing culture of political writing from prisons. And you also have the politicization of all of these social activities like drug use, like sex work, like border crossing, all of these things that become criminalized over the course of the 20th century and create all sorts of new vulnerabilities, all sorts of new political communities. All of that is happening because of these transformations I just outlined with regard to the prison.
You noted that although Iran has an enormous prison population, it is still dwarfed by the United States, and how Iran's prison population increased over the course of the 20th century. And I wanted to ask you, given the global nature of mass incarceration, especially in our era, how would you situate the Iranian prison system or carceral state in that global context, even though, of course, Iran has been a pariah state for the United States and its allies? There seem to be commonalities nonetheless with this infrastructure of mass incarceration.
The Iranian prison system, we really cannot think of it the way that we are told to think of it often in mainstream context, as a kind of pathological outgrowth of a particularly violent and even medieval Islamic system, that it is some sort of outgrowth of Iran's rogue government or rogue people, a kind of a sign of cultural or religious or political pathology, right? That to me is a totally historically wrong-headed way to look at the situation, not to mention a deeply racist and ultimately quite warmongering way to look at the prison situation in Iran. In my research, what I have discovered is just how global Iran's prison system was and is from the outset until the current day. What do I mean by that? In the first place, Iran's prisons, modern prisons, were built with, in conversation with and through the efforts of Iranian law enforcement agencies, in conversation with European criminologists and police and prison conferences in Europe in the 1920s and 30s. So this idea that Iran is absorbing and attempting to establish what were then considered sort of global best practices for law and punishment, the Pahlavi government is trying to reform Iran's punishment system along what were then essentially European lines. By the time the 1950s and 60s rolled around, the major influence on Iranian prison architectures becomes American, right? So as the United States takes the central kind of imperial role in the Iranian context, the prisons that are built in the 1960s in particular are essentially built along American architectures, right? So even today, prisons in Iran, in Mashhad and Shiraz, are built on the blueprints from an American prison, USP Marion, which is today the smallest prison in the U.S. supermax system, right? But was built essentially at the same time, just a couple years prior to these Iranian counterparts in the 1960s, as both the American and the Iranian governments and carceral states are attempting to sort of deal with new crises in its prison systems. Those prisons have all sorts of new ideas for how they should be run, which include things like expanded prison factories, expanded solitary confinement, expanded in-prison group therapy. So all of that is being sort of imported into the Iranian context from what are essentially Euro-American models, more so the American once the latter half of the 20th century rolls around. So we are told all the time that Iran and the United States are sort of absolutely or diametrically opposed systems in terms of their approach to law. You know, that one is a sort of liberal democracy and the other is exceptionalized as uniquely illiberal. But in fact, we see that these institutional and infrastructural edifice of repression is in many cases built from quite literally blueprints. And they're using the same language of reform, of transformation, of humanizing punishment, of educating prisoners, of allowing them to do prison labor to transform, right? That these are essentially global rubrics and models. They take particular form in the Iranian context. I never want to lose sight of the particularity, right? They're not just sort of grafted onto the Iranian context without contestation, without transformation. But the architectures, the economies, the techniques, the practices of modern incarceration, in my view, we can't really coherently say that there's liberal punishment or fascist punishment or Islamic punishment. We're really looking at systems that are a bit more similar than we really give them credit for. And one of the things we see in these prison systems across the world, whether we're talking about Iran or the US or, you know, there's several other contexts, is that they expand. They promise the eradication or the transformation of crime, but once they are established, they simply expand. The prisons get full. More prisons have to be built. More prisoners are incarcerated, and there's just an exponential increase in the number of people who are put behind bars. That has continued in Iran until the current moment. And in the current moment, some of the techniques that it's using to try to reduce its prisoner total, which it has avowed wanting to do for the last 15 years, from the highest levels, from Khamenei on down, has been talking about reducing the number of people behind bars because it's expensive, because it's socially not wanted, and so forth. But a lot of the techniques that they're using to instantiate those reforms are themselves global carceral technologies, things like biometric surveillance, facial recognition surveillance around cities, ankle monitors to have people released on their own recognizance. And those technologies are also global. So we see the way in which global carceral technologies are shared, they're linked, they're transnational. They're used in particular ways, like in the United States. Obviously, the carceral state and mass incarceration is deeply racialized. It has to do with the unique history of transatlantic slavery in the Americas and the particular racism of the American state. That same political context isn't present in the Iranian context. Different people are made vulnerable. Different populations are criminalized. But the logics and the infrastructures and the economies are shared in ways that I think are often made invisible.
Gulnar, we'll have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so, so much. This has been a pleasure.
Gulnar Nikpur is the author of The Incarcerated Modern, Prisons and Public Life in Iran. She's associate professor of history at Dartmouth. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.